peaceful nuclear protest. What would you be willing to do to protest nuclear weapons in a meaningful public way? If you're a member of the Plowshares movement, an anti-nuclear weapons and Christian pacifist movement that advocates active resistance to war, you would put yourself on the line, peacefully, for your beliefs, and then deal with the consequences. It's a sacrifice not many of us are willing to make. But then you talk with a dedicated activist who has just concluded her latest prison sentence for protesting nuclear weapons and ask her why she does it. And she tells you.
So we look at, say, the prophet Isaiah or the prophet Micah that talked about hammering swords into plowshares and spears into preening hooks. And we think, who is this they that should be doing that? Oh, it must be us. So we have to begin converting these weapons of war into something useful for human life, like a blacksmith does. And we have to begin converting our hearts from hearts of stone to hearts of compassion. And we have to convert our military system into a peace system. We have to convert from putting all our money into war making and weapons if we're ever going to address climate change and mitigation.
Well, when 81-year-old Susan Crane of the Plowshares movement explains her motivations for standing up against nuclear weapons and her willingness to serve prison time as a result, we learn that heroes come in all forms and are willing to lead us, if only we will follow, out of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Susan Crane. She is a member of the anti-nuclear weapons and Christian pacifist Plowshares movement, and she, along with others, have been peacefully protesting U.S. nuclear weapons stored and maintained at Germany's Buschel Air Force Base, using only their bodies, banners, Bibles, and blood. We spoke shortly after she was released from German prison about what motivates her and what we need to think about when considering the continued existence of nuclear weapons in our world. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, an exciting announcement about a project near and dear to my heart, and more honest nuclear information than Elon Musk has yet been able to expunge from the public awareness. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 11, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., nonprofit public interest groups have reached an historic settlement agreement with the Department of Energy's Nuclear Weapons Agency, the National Nuclear Security Administration, or NNSA. This was a lawsuit against NNSA over its failure to complete an environmental impact statement on the expanded production of plutonium pit bomb cores at both Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico and for the first time ever at the Savannah River site in South Carolina. The National Environmental Policy Act requires an environmental impact statement be done on both sites, and both the Department of Energy and the NNSA were judged as having violated this requirement by failing to properly consider alternatives before proceeding with their plans to produce plutonium pits, a critical component of nuclear weapons, at both sites. The lawsuit was first filed in June of 2021 by co-plaintiffs Savannah Riverside Watch of Columbia, South Carolina, Nuclear Watch New Mexico of Santa Fe, New Mexico, Tri-Valley Communities Against a Radioactive Environment, or CARES, based in Livermore, California, and the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition of Coastal Georgia. For now, this is a huge win because the process of preparing facilities and materials to manufacture those bomb pits cannot proceed until that report is filed for each of the sites. And while the National Nuclear Security Administration, NNSA, is not perfect, we do need it. And before long, it may run afoul of Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, put that in quotes and call it DOGE, as it continues its witch hunt looking for targets for budget cutting, including those that are classified. The NNSA was created by Congress in 1999 to consolidate several Department of Energy functions under one bureaucratic roof. Acquiring fissile material, manufacturing nuclear weapons, and preventing America's nuclear technology from leaking. It has all manner of sensitive information on hand, including nuclear weapon designs and blueprints for reactors that power Navy ships and submarines. It's an 1,800-person organization that burns through $20 billion every year, much of it on classified work. The danger, based on Musk's incursions into other agencies, is the exposure of sensitive, classified information to unqualified personnel. According to several nuclear security experts and former senior department officials, taking this approach at the NNSA could make nuclear material at home and abroad less safe. Oh, goody. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out a week.
The Department of Energy has announced that it is going to be babysitting and handholding the nuclear industry by providing $13 million to support what they call advanced nuclear reactor licensing activities. This new grant program is meant to offset fees associated with licensing reactors and facilities. Right. Like anything in the nuclear industry actually needs government support in order to get further government support. You can tell the attitude of the DOE towards this program because they repeatedly refer to these as advanced reactors. No, they're new. They don't yet exist. There are more than 80 designs under consideration, and there's not even a test reactor out there to find out if these buggers are going to work. But DOE has gotten all gushy over these, claiming that these small reactors, which by the way refers to the size of their energy output, less so than their actual physical footprint, and the amount of radioactive waste they create, which is kilowatt per kilowatt, more than that of the current crop of full-sized nuclear reactors. But DOE's press release loves to point out that these cute little reactors could also come in a range of sizes. Also, colors. Chrome trim. That these little nukettes would be flexible enough to pair with renewable generation. Say what? And benefit markets beyond electricity. Yeah, like those markets that are dealing with the cleanup of radioactive waste and still doing a pea-poor job of it. This funding opportunity will be open for a period of 5 years with up to $50 million available to underwrite the fees associated with licensing. And you can bet this is one program that will not be canceled out by what's currently happening with Musk and Doge. And that's why Department of Energy and this totally gratuitous let's give money to the people who already have money program, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
Over to Japan, where Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, announced that it will dismantle water tanks in Fukushima starting as early as this week. A total of 21 tanks will be dismantled. These were used to hold water. These were used to hold radioactive water that was siphoned out of the remains of the nuclear reactors. This is water that comes down the hillside from rain and drains into the site, becoming radioactive in the process. TEPCO always states that the water in these tanks was treated, but they all still contain radioactive tritium, which cannot be removed from the water. The tanks are empty because this is the water that TEPCO has been dumping into the Pacific Ocean, thus releasing radioactive tritium into the waters over the protests of their own fishing industry and China, which has totally banned import of seafood from Japan since the water release began. TEPCO says that they will be using the land freed by the demolition of these 21 tanks to build facilities such as storage for nuclear fuel debris, which is scheduled to be removed from Unit 3 reactor. No word where the radioactive material that was used to build the tanks themselves is going to be stored. Perhaps in these new buildings? And Japan is claiming that their 2024 food exports hit a record high despite China's seafood import bans. Helping to offset that impact was the United States, Taiwan, and Vietnam. What's not usually mentioned is that the purchase of possibly radioactive scallops from Japan by the U.S. has led to them being fed to the U.S. military stationed in that country. Over to Ukraine, where International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Grossi met with President Vladimir Zelensky and assess damage to energy infrastructure vital for nuclear safety. It was Grossi's 11th visit to Ukraine since the military conflict began almost 3 years ago. Before the meeting, Grossi traveled to one of the substations on which Ukraine's nuclear power plants depend to receive the off-site power needed to cool their reactors and for other essential nuclear safety and security functions. In recent months, Ukraine's three operating nuclear power plants have several times been forced to reduce power output because of widespread military activities affecting the electricity grid, most recently on February 1st. Grossi told journalists at the substation, "The reason that this is so important from the perspective of the IAEA is because of the influence of this situation on the safety of the nuclear power plant's operation. This compromises the safety of the power plant and could eventually lead to an accident. Having an external power supply is essential." He went on to add, "The situation is quite dire. We should not, I think, hide that fact. This infrastructure has been degraded." The Zaporizhzhia site consists of 6 nuclear reactors, none of them currently operating, but all of them in danger of an accident to their fuel pools and their containment structures. In India, amendments are in the works to that country's Atomic Energy Act and Civil Liability for Nuclear Damage Act, meant to accommodate U.S. reactor suppliers' interests to the detriment of the overall safety of operation of imported nuclear reactors. The opponents of this change are calling for a clear-cut liability to remain on the supplier of nuclear equipment and materials in case they are found to be defective. This new bill, in its proposed version, is perceived to be an escape route to the suppliers of nuclear materials, equipments, services of the employees, or gross negligence, and would make it difficult to establish responsibility for payment in a civil nuclear compensation case. It is perceived to be part of the ongoing push for the nuclear industry to not be responsible for the consequences of their actions. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, the United Nations meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, is fast upon us. The 73 countries that have signed and ratified the ban, which is international law, along with others in the ratification process, considering the treaty, or just observing the process, will come together at the United Nations for the third meeting of states parties on March 3rd through 7th. I covered the second meeting of states parties for Nuclear Hot Seat in December 2023 and produced 2 programs on it, episodes 650 and 651. In them, I presented interviews with diplomats, politicians, and activists from around the world that captured the excitement, optimism, difficulties, hard work, strategies, and shared love of life of this international community. My intention is to once again be there to bring you the information from international representatives of the movement to rid this planet of nuclear weapons. To that end, I have booked my flight, but I still have to pay for it because this trip is well over and above the regular running expenses for the show. That's where you come in. I'm asking for your help in the form of a donation of any size. It's tax deductible, be this a one-time donation of any amount, or as a sustaining member for as little as $5 a month, the same as a cup of coffee and a tip to the barista here in the U.S. It's easy to do either one. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or if you prefer, you can send money through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Know that I'm excited to once again be able to bring you information from the front lines of anti-nuclear activism around the world. So whatever you can do to help, you are making a difference to the show and to the world. And that, as always, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. What are you willing to do to rid the world of nuclear weapons? Some of us sign petitions, write letters, make phone calls, produce a weekly podcast. And then there are others who put their bodies on the line to protest in the most powerful way they can. Susan Crane is one of those, a peace activist, a member of the California Catholic Worker Movement, and a participant in the Plowshares Anti-Nuclear Weapons and Christian Pacifist Movement. After decades of civil disobedience to bring attention to the need to rid our planet of nuclear weapons, she was arrested in Germany for protesting U.S. nuclear weapons stored and maintained at Germany's Buschel Air Force Base. She was arrested and sentenced to jail time in German prison in 2024. She was released just last month, on January 17, 2025, and we spoke with Susan Crane just 4 weeks later, on Friday, February 7, 2025. Susan Crane, what an honor and what a gift to be able to speak with you for Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for hosting me.
Let's start out with people understanding a bit more about you. What is your background, and how did you first become active in protesting against nuclear weapons?
Well, I guess I've been many things in my life, a teacher. I've worked in plumbing and electrical trades. But mostly throughout all that, I've been concerned about disparities and why some people are poor, why some people are discriminated against. So that's been sort of a theme of providing food to people and working towards some sort of justice. And the injustice of the racism and the economic imbalance and some people in war and some people killing others and people, the misery of war has always hit me hard, I guess, has always brought up the feeling that we should do better as humans towards each other. After college, I went into the Peace Corps, and I realized that when I was in Ethiopia, that despite the poverty, the U.S. was already controlling things there, and that we had a secret military base there and controlled and kept Haile Selassie in power and told the Ethiopians who their trading partners should be and who they shouldn't trade with. And I realized the problem wasn't just that people needed education. We needed to stop oppressing. The countries that oppress need to stop oppressing others. The people who oppress others need to figure out ways to work mutually together with everyone. So that's sort of where I'm coming from. And I get restless when I feel compliant with the war-making government that I'm living in. And I try to withdraw my compliance. And I've done that in many ways, but going to demonstrations, that's good. Withdrawing my tax for war, that's good, but it hasn't seemed like enough. And being part of demonstrations at Livermore Lab and the Concord Naval Weapons Station against the weapons, that's good, but still it wasn't enough, I felt.
You have said that you're part of the Plowshares movement. What is that, and how long have you been involved with it?
The Plowshares movement basically started in the United States in 1980. And the idea is that we look at nuclear weapons and we see that people put their trust in them. And we feel that that's idolatry, that we shouldn't be putting our trust in nuclear weapons, that security does not come from these weapons, that security and peace are not the fruits of war. Security comes from mutual respect and getting along with others. So we look at, say, the prophet Isaiah or the prophet Micah that talked about hammering swords into plowshares and spears into preening hooks. And we think, who is this they that should be doing that? Oh, it must be us. So we have to begin converting these weapons of war into something useful for human life, like a blacksmith does. And we have to begin converting our hearts from hearts of stone to hearts of compassion. And we have to convert our military system into a peace system. We have to convert from putting all our money into war making and weapons into things that help human and the climate. The symbols that we use are hammers, which can be used to build things, but also can be used to take things apart. And blood, because we pour our own blood on the weapons or on the fence or as close as we can get to the weapons. You know, war making is a very bloody thing. And we don't, in the United States, we don't so much see the blood. And so we try to make the blood visible. And it's also a sign of, we all have blood in us. We're all human. We're all united in this way. And we are ultimately brothers and sisters, and we need to start treating each other as brothers and sisters, our near neighbors and our far neighbors.
You've been involved in many protests. You've also been arrested for many of them. Give us a sense of the protests you've been involved in.
If we're ever going to address climate change and mitigation, if we're ever going to do something about that, we need to stop putting all this money into the military and stop producing all the military greenhouse gases. And base there, focusing on the climate preservation. Those are loaded onto the Trident subs, and the subs roam the ocean, and they can attack anywhere in the world with nuclear weapons within, say, 20 minutes. Those nuclear weapons are stored at the base up there, the Bangor base, and we decided we were going to address those weapons and bring attention to them. And so we studied together, several of us, for many months, and we decided to go in at night. And so one night we went in to the base, we cut a hole in the fence and walked through, and we started walking through the base, and we had an idea of where we wanted to go. The moon was out that night, and we could see the path. We had this idea that if a car came on the road, we would jump into the bushes. But of course, a car did come on the road, but some of us were nearby bushes and they jumped in. But I was at a place where there was a cross street, so there were no bushes to jump into. So we just talked to each other as if that was where we were supposed to be, and the car drove on and nothing happened. That was pretty amazing to us. And we continued walking. We walked about 3 hours through the night. Finally, we were still walking towards where we thought the weapons were stored. And it was shift change on the base. And so all the soldiers were coming, new soldiers were coming in, and the soldiers that were working were leaving. And they were all passing us. And the five of us were walking single file along the road. Now, we weren't just walking. We had tools. We had long clippers that were like 2 feet long, holding them on our shoulders, but no one paid any attention to us. It was like we were invisible. It was pretty amazing. And we finally got to where the storage area was, and we were quite happy to have gotten that far. We gathered and said a prayer, and we had to walk through an area that was clear cut around the perimeter of the fence. We thought perhaps that they had cameras or that that would be a place where we would be stopped. But we walked through that. We walked up to the first fence. Some of us put a banner up. Others started cutting. And we went through. And we were inside this middle area and we had another fence to go. So we know we're in a shoot to kill area, but at the same time, we have our banners and we have our intention of peacemaking, and we continued. And as we were getting through the second fence, we could see the soldiers driving up in their armored vehicle. And eventually we got through, poured our blood, and the soldiers took us down and put sacks over our head like they did to the Guantanamo prisoners. It was quite a surprise. And they left us there handcuffed, lying on the ground for about 3 hours because they had trouble deciding how to get us out. Because apparently the area was so secure that even the base security cars couldn't go in there to get us out. So they decided to lift us up one by one. They carried us and passed us through the fence, through the holes that we had made. They had to pass us through both fences. And then they put us in separate police cars, and then they took us and investigated us. And we had, as a group, decided we would talk about nuclear weapons, and we would talk about that only. So that's what we all did. We were individually talked to. There were five of us.
When did this take place, and what were the consequences of it?
It was in 2009, and we went to court. We went to trial. And we were sentenced to a couple of years in prison.
And did you serve those couple of years in prison?
Oh, yes. I was part of four different Plowshares actions. So I had done about a little more than 6 years in prison by then after that.
Bushehr is a German airbase, and Germany does not have nuclear weapons, at least not their own. Why protest nukes there?
Well, they happen to be nukes that belong to the United States. There was a group of 64 German peace organizations that had a peace camp there every year and were protesting these weapons. The German people don't want nuclear weapons here, and we don't want them either. And so they came to the United States to a national gathering of Catholic workers and showed us slideshows of what they're doing and invited us who were protesting against nuclear weapons here in the U.S. to help them because, after all, they're our weapons, the U.S. weapons. So that year, John LaForge at Nuke Watch organized a peace delegation, a U.S. peace delegation to Germany, and we went and demonstrated against the weapons with the German people.
For this most recent protest that you were part of at Bushehr, what kind of planning had to go into that? And do you maintain a spiritual basis in putting one of these together?
Well, that's an interesting question, because at the peace camp, there were Catholic workers from Amsterdam. There were, of course, several Catholic workers from the U.S. and from Germany. There's Catholic workers, and also from England. There were some Catholic workers there. So we had a spiritual basis. However, there were also people who believed in nonviolence and believed that these weapons are wrong. They're indiscriminate. The radiation has no boundaries. The peat and the blast just kills civilians and soldiers. They're terrible. And so people had different motivations, whether it was ethical or spiritual or however you want to say it. And we all worked together. People were very open to everyone's ideas. And I think that worked very well. You know, if you're committed to nonviolence and you're committed to getting rid of war and war making and everything that goes with it, then that's enough, right?
It makes us a tribe internationally and we all get along.
Yes. And there's something very empowering in that. There was something really wonderful working with that group to come together from all different countries and say, this is what we think, and let's put it into practice. Let's go on to the base. There wasn't a lot of discussion about did direct action need to happen, because the people who were there had decided that direct action was good.
How was this most recent direct action, the one that resulted in your most recent imprisonment, How was that planned, and what was done to, as best possible, guarantee the safety of those who were protesting and actually going on the base?
First of all, I was there over 2017, 2018, and 2019, and we did go-in actions each of those years, and I was charged with six actions. So it wasn't just one.
And that's what resulted in your most recent prison sentence.
Yes, so other people, like the German people, when they did an action, then they went to court almost right away and they did the time for that action. But for the people from the US, they let them pile up, and we didn't know if they were ever going to bring us into court so we could talk to a judge. But then they did, and they put all the actions together.
Describe this most recent one, because it's certainly one that I've been covering through the work of John LaForge, who has had his own report on this show many times. What did it consist of, and walk us through so we can understand where you were and what you were doing?
I usually, when I talk about these actions, I usually talk about the one where we took bread onto the base, or I talk about the one where John and I were weapons inspectors, or the large action we did, which we call the five holes action. That was when we had about 18 people that agreed they wanted to go onto the base. And we had a statement that we had, John in part, and John mostly had written, which we all agreed with, to the personnel of the base, talking about how the weapons were illegal and they should resign their commission and not load them. And talking about international law and how international law was being broken. So we had this in German and in English, and our intention was to give it to the soldiers that we met or to read it to them.
And when did this take place?
This was in 2018. So we divided up into groups, and there were Americans and people from the Netherlands and people from Germany in each group, and each group had a little support group. And we went to an area of the fence, which was actually right near the main gate. We were right out there in front, and we went up to the fence together. So we were these five groups, and we were separated by about 10 feet each. And we made a hole in the fence. And we each of us went through. So it happened simultaneously. We had decided we were going to try to get to the bunker. So we didn't listen to anyone saying stop, and we just kept walking straight through the bushes, through a field, and we saw the bunkers. We went up to them and climbed up on top of one of them. Fritz was there from the Amsterdam Catholic Worker, and he had a little camera he had sequestered away, and he took a picture and sent it out. And that was a picture that was in the press the next day of us on top of the bunker with a banner saying nuclear weapons illegal and immoral. We were up there quite a while, and we thought, wow, this is a long time to be up here. So we decided to get down and do something else. I don't know, we were going to go up on another bunker. And when we got down, the military had found us, pulled their guns out, and were very concerned. And we had our banner. We said, we're peaceful people, and started to read the statement. And Fritz was writing on the bunker. They arrested us, and or they held us and brought us back to where everyone else was already gathered, being processed. It took a long time to process all 18 people. We were in this little area, this little office area, and the soldiers gave us tea. And, it's all very polite, and we could talk to them about why we were there and what we were doing. And
It sounds very civilized.
very civilized. They never put cuffs on us, they weren't rough. So then they put us all in a bus. And they told us not to look out the window. And they drove us through the base to another exit, because if they had just let us go, we would have been right near the peace camp, because the peace camp was right near the main gate. And I think they wanted to make us walk a long ways back to the peace camp to sort of punish us. It might be the only punishment we'd get, right? So they let us out. And our friends, our support people, were very clever and saw the bus head a different direction. So they went over to that, drove over to that gate to meet us. And so we have a picture of all of us standing there with our banners in front of the big bus as we got out. It was really a very sweet action, and there was a lot of joy because we had gotten in, we had brought the statement, we had read it to soldiers and talked to them, and it seemed the right thing to do.
So having done this series of actions for which you were not brought to trial, why suddenly was the decision made, or how did you suddenly learn that you were going to be brought to trial, and what reason was given for it, or what anticipation did you have about it?
Well, finally, I was very happy to get a summons to go to court because I had wanted to bring this up in a courtroom. You know, we had heard about the judges in Germany from Ulf Panzer, who was one of the judges, who had joined the protesters when they were against the Pershing missiles that were being deployed in Germany years ago. And so those judges had sat and sentenced people for many years. And finally, they thought, these protesters actually are right, and we should join them. And so they had some meetings, and they joined the line. They joined the blockade line. So I thought, well, with that sort of history, I want to talk to these judges about international law and how it's being broken, and about the poverty in the United States, which people don't always know about, and about how every time I see someone who's living rough in the bushes, I think about these nuclear weapons that are better cared for than humans, than our children, than our people. And I think about the waste of resources that goes into these weapons. So I wanted to get into court, and I was happy to have the summons. So I came from the United States to Germany. I came back to go to trial. And at the end of the first trial, which was interesting because I did get to talk about what I wanted to say, I did get to talk about the disparity between the money spent on war making and the lack of money for social services, medical care, roads, and all that in the United States. And I did get to talk about international law and the Geneva Conventions, the Nuremberg Principles, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But they didn't pay any attention to that. They only said, well, did you own the land? Do you trespass? You trespassed on land that wasn't yours. You cut the fence, and therefore you're guilty.
And you said this is the first trial.
Yes.
Why was there more than one?
Because then after that trial, I said to this lawyer who had come to help me, Milan Martin, I want to appeal this. So we appealed.
Wait a minute. After the first one, you were found guilty?
Guilty. There's been no innocent findings. All guilty. All along. We appealed to the regional court in Koblenz. Then we appealed to the higher court. And then we appealed to the Constitutional Court in Germany, which is like the Supreme Court, the highest court. And then we appealed to the European Court of Human Rights.
Were you able to give your message about nukes being illegal during all of these hearings or all of these reviews? Or was that continually excluded and it was just a matter of you were where you weren't supposed to be?
Well, we could talk about it ourselves, but we weren't allowed to have expert witnesses like Francis Boyle or Annabel Dwyer, or there were German judges and scientists who wanted to be heard that we offered as our expert witnesses, but they were never allowed. I think if the judges had actually looked at the law and accepted that the law existed, that treaty law existed and German law existed the way it does, that they would have found us not guilty. But they said they wouldn't accept any affirmative defense. They wouldn't accept that there would be a reason that we should go on the base. They wouldn't accept that the weapons were criminal in themselves. The judge said to me, these weapons were placed there by a duly elected German government, and therefore they're legal.
You can twist your brain into a pretzel to justify just about anything, as we're seeing here in the United States right now.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, you were tried at the same time as Dutch peace activist Susan van der Heijden, who became known as the Two Susans. She served 115 days, while you received a sentence of 230 days, twice as long. Why the discrepancy?
Well, we weren't tried at the same time.
Oh, okay.
German people were all tried first, and then they decided to try the people from the Netherlands. And then they decided to try the people from the U.S. But anyway, we did those actions together, but I did six, and she did three.
So. You got twice the sentence because you did twice as many.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I was just wondering if you were considered that much more dangerous than Susan. You were just that much more persistent. How rigorous and how difficult was the imprisonment that you faced? How were you treated?
This is my personal experience. You know, my experience at Rohrbach, where we first went, was we were put in cells. The standard for the prison is you're in your cell by yourself for 22 hours a day. You eat your meals in your cell. You're in your cell unless you have a job or unless you have a class. It was a men's prison in general. There were about maybe 400 men and 75 women. So the men could go to classes. The men could go to German classes. The women could not go to any classes. The men had the lion's share of jobs in the prison, like the kitchen and the general maintenance outside and the, you know, general maintenance inside. And the women just had the laundry for the women and the food, serving the food for the women, that sort of housekeeping jobs. So we were there for 2 months. And during that time, they allowed us to share a cell. So I wasn't alone. We weren't alone. We were together. But still, we were in the room most of the day.
And after those 2 months?
After those 2 months, they moved us to another place. But at that first prison, there were a lot of women that had mental health challenges and had experienced trauma. And, you know, as a former school teacher, I found it very hard to witness women being alone all day in a cell without any chance for education or help. You know, I don't think it was a very good situation for them.
Did you have any ability to do outreach to them on a one-to-one basis?
Well, we had an hour together at a rec where we outside. All the women were together for 1 hour a day outside. But that's not a whole lot of time.
No, it's not. Moving this along, when you were moved from that first prison, where did you go and did your circumstances change?
They moved us to Koblenz, a military city, and a little closer to the base. It was a prison where most of the women had jobs outside. Like they'd go to their job in the morning, come back at night, and they'd be in the prison overnight and, you know, start that same thing over again. I thought, well, how am I ever going to get a job here? You know, I don't want to sit here all day by myself in this prison. So the boss of the prison called up Pastor Stahl, who was a superintendent of the evangelical churches around there in that area, in the large area, and asked him if he could give me a job. And the pastor said, yes, she can work here. So that's what happened. And I worked from 8 in the morning or 7:30 in the morning till about 1. And so during that time, I did gardening, leaf raking, things like that that needed to be done. But also it was a time when people could visit me. And it was a time where I could write some letters. A lot of good things happened then. I got to meet the folks from the anarchist leftist community and the church community. And the church was in an area that was Eastern European, somewhat poor area. And the women there were just, it was astounding meeting them and talking to them and listening to their stories and realizing that, well, one woman said, I didn't know there was poverty in the United States. But both of the women said, brother fighting brother doesn't make any sense. They've seen war. They said killing each other is the result of war, and it doesn't make any sense, and we just destroy people and houses and buildings, and the leaders have to negotiate. It was wonderful to be able to talk to people. I talked to a lot of people there, a lot of people in the evangelical, the Protestant church, a lot of people in the Catholic church. I just had a chance to talk, and it was nice to hear people's ideas and talk with them and sort of live a life there.
You were released from prison in Germany on January 17, 2025, which is just a little over 3 weeks ago as we are talking.
Yes.
What have you been doing since to recover and or celebrate?
Everywhere I go, I went to my street band practice, and everyone was just so kind and gave me hugs and celebrated that I was out and celebrated that I had resisted and been able to stay till the end. And they said, you know, we were with you the whole time. And I went to my community band, and the director welcomed me back in front of everyone and said she agreed with what I had done and that we do have to find peaceful ways. And she said, you know, she was with me the whole time. So there's a lot of that. And, you know, there's a lot of people who wrote to me while I was in prison. There were a lot of people who did support, like Jack and Felice at the Nuclear Resistor and John LaForge, and in Germany, Marion Kupker and Chris Danowski. So much support for me and so much love and so much, it was a very special time of receiving a lot of kindness from other people.
You are now 81 years old and just spent 7.5 months in prison for your beliefs, for which I thank you. Why do you keep doing it? And is there something coming up on the agenda next for you?
The nuclear weapons are still there, and things in the United States have not gotten better. They've gotten worse. And I find resistance is the only way I can feel like I'm being human. I feel a restlessness if I'm not doing something to resist the craziness and the madness. And there's joy in resisting. You know, one of the youth from our house yesterday was part of a immigrant demonstration, and she took the day off from school and walked around town with flyers and signs. And she came home and she just had that joy of resisting in her face and in her words, and just reminded me, you know, that's when I feel alive, when I'm saying there's a better way to do this. And we do need to love one another. We need to even love our enemies. We need to find a different way to relate to each other than violence and killing each other.
What do you hope your work will inspire in others?
While I was in prison, I was able to give a talk at the Koblenz University, because the chaplain came and talked to me at the church and set it up with the boss of the prison. And I looked out over this group of people that I was talking to about nuclear weapons and about the need for resistance and about some of the actions I had done, like I'm talking to you. And I saw the young anarchists who had helped me so much in support. And I saw the left, people from the left. And I saw people who came for religious reasons. The pastor who helped me was there. And I saw the prison boss was there. And all these students were there from the university. And I thought, this is hopeful. This is wonderful. It was wonderful that people were there and they had good questions. But it was also wonderful that they were there together. You know, it's like, we need to work together. We need to work with everyone, with all the areas of politicians, with the communists, with the liberals, with everyone. And we need to work with people of all faiths.
How much longer do you think you'll be able to keep doing this? How much longer do you plan to keep doing this work?
I guess until I'm called home to God.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you would like to mention now?
We didn't talk about the B-61 nuclear weapons that are there in Germany, these gravity bombs. We didn't talk about how they're being replaced with bombs that can be targeted. the B-61-12s, which cost more than their weight in gold for the U.S. to make. We didn't talk about how all the nuclear weapons in the U.S. are being remade, enhanced, and how much money that's going to take and how many generations it's going to take to build it. And oh, well, we also didn't mention the climate and how the military is one of the bigger producers of greenhouse gases, and yet the militaries don't even have to track how many greenhouse gases they make. IPPNW, or the International Physicians Against Nuclear War, were very active in Germany, and they were very supportive of my action. People from the IPPNW wrote to me long letters of support, but they also co-published this flyer called Climate Crossfire, which talks about the military and NATO, and if we're ever going to address climate change and mitigation, if we're ever going to do something about that, we need to stop putting all this money into the military and stop producing all the military greenhouse gases and start focusing on the climate preservation.
I'm going to have to interview you again. Susan Crane, you are an inspiration. You are a joy to speak with. You are certainly a model for what a meaningful activist life can look like. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Libby.
Susan Crane of the Plowshares Anti-Nuclear Weapons and Christian Pacifist Movement.
Activists, shout out.
We'll start out with what for me is just sensational news. Regular listeners to the show will have heard me through the years mention a play that I was working on, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. It's an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story about media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. It both asks and answers the question, how do you hide a nuclear bomb blast in plain sight? And how do you hide the consequences? Well, after more than a dozen years of work, I am just thrilled to announce that the play will receive its world premiere presentation at the Wilmington Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College in Ohio as part of their 50th anniversary celebration. The show will receive a staged reading by the entire Wilmington Theater College Department, and they've just set the date for September 9, 2025 at 7:30 p.m. We're still in early talks about exactly what this is going to look like and how this is going to play out, but know that the potential to live stream it is being discussed. If we're able to pull that off, that means that you, anywhere in the world, will be able to view this staged reading. I don't know that I could be any more excited, especially considering that I know what's in that play, and I can't wait until you do. Know that to be part of this celebration by a world-renowned Peace Resource Center is a tremendous honor and marks the peak of my other career, playwriting, for which I've had more than 50 productions and won awards around the world. I'll continue to, in activist shout-outs, shout out to myself, and keep you up to date on what's happening with Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. For now, looking at the world and the many changes that are taking place that don't look like they're going to be positive for a lot of us, it's good to have one thing in my life that makes me smile. From our friends and cohort in Brazil, who put together the International Uranium Film Festival, comes the first announcement of dates that are fixed for 2025. The dates that are locked in are in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, May 17 to 31st, Berlin, Germany, October 7 through 12, and here in continental United States, at Window Rock in Navajo Nation, the 7th and 8th of November. And after Window Rock, we're working with Ian Zabarte to once again have the International Uranium Film Festival in Las Vegas. We will link to the film festival website, and as we get closer to the dates, We'll let you know if other cities have been confirmed. And if you wish to contact them about booking the International Uranium Film Festival in your area, we'll have a link to their email on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 711. And there's a new video out that was done by the Lakenheath Alliance for Peace, from Greenham to Lakenheath. This is to drum up awareness and support the actions at the Royal Air Force Lakenheath Base in Suffolk, England, where there is going to be a peace camp held from April 14 to 21, 2025. Here at Nuclear Hot Seat, we're very excited and proud about this video because it uses as audio Jack Cohen Joppa's Nuclear Hot Seat Nuclear Resistor feature from episode number 709. In it, he tells the story of the legendary anti-nuclear victory in England when British women came together at the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp and succeeded in kicking U.S. nuclear missiles out of the country. The Lakenheath Peace Camp is being modeled on the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, so knowing the history of one tremendously successful action is a great way to support this new one. We will have that video posted up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, again, episode number 711, and we thank the Lakenheath Alliance for Peace for having given us full credit, for utilizing the material, and for helping to continue to get the word out about Nuclear Hot Seat. Speaking of which, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 11, 2025. If you'd like to get this program delivered to you via email every week, it's easy, and it's the best way possible for you to not miss a single episode. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, but what's better for us is if you go to nuclearhotseat.com. In the yellow opt-in box, you really can't miss it. That thing just smashes you in the nose when you get to the page. In the yellow box, put in your first name and email address, and every week, you will get one, just one, I don't bug you, one email with the link to that week's program and a short description of the show's content. This way, you never miss a single episode of the show, and you can dazzle your friends or clear out the room with all the latest nuclear information. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, let us know. Send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, especially with this trip to the United Nations coming up, we really need your help. Whatever you can do to help support us, we are deeply grateful. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Hiroshima survivor Setsko Thurlow said upon accepting the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the nuclear arsenal represents a self-destruct button for the human race. To which we add, let's not push it. There you go, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So, whatever you do from this point forward, don't go back to sleep. That's because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.